It is nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT, broadcasting on 100.1 FM. We are your public radio station here in Kodiak, Alaska, where it is 56 degrees under a light rain. They are registering southeast winds to 12 miles per hour and 90% humidity at the airport, where they also have 10 miles of visibility still. Look for more rain for the rest of the day, a high near 60, south winds to 15, gusting to 20. Just scattered showers early on this evening. Cloudy skies will gradually become partly cloudy tonight, with a low around 59, low around 50 rather, west wind gusting to 25. And for tomorrow, mostly sunny skies with just a 10% chance of showers tomorrow afternoon. Coming up on the Midday Report, new science shows the Arctic might be warming four times more quickly than the rest of the world. Kirsten Dobroth talks with Mike Litzo about what that could mean for coastal communities and fishermen. And a new barge has sunk in a river up north.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Long lines are forming outside water distribution sites in Jackson, Mississippi, where tens of thousands of people are searching for water that's safe to drink, cook with, and shower in. Severe floods exacerbated long-standing problems in one of two water treatment plants. Macy Brown, who says she's a junior at Jackson State University, says she was especially concerned about the ability of elderly and people with disabilities to get to distribution sites. But with the help of Jackson and other students, the water is coming to them.
Pound 2 0 3 3 0.
That's Jackson navigating her way through a residential building where people have been waiting for her.
People who need help, who really deserve help, and it's already hard enough, as is. So adding on the fact that your water is dangerous to drink and use is just a whole another layer of issues.
Jackson says she and others set up a hotline for donations to buy water. She says 20 to 25 students from across Jackson are helping her. The Biden administration has also pledged federal assistance to Jackson's residents. The Justice Department is pushing back on what it describes as baseless accusations from former President Donald Trump. NPR's Kerry Johnson reports prosecutors are offering new details about their probe of top secret documents found at Trump's resort in Florida.
Federal prosecutors say they developed evidence Trump was not cooperating with the investigation. They say they learned papers had been removed from a storage room at Mar-a-Lago and other steps were taken to obstruct the federal probe. The Justice Department shared those details in an effort to push back on Trump's bid for an independent special master to review the papers. DOJ says there's no legal basis for that move, and it would only delay an urgent need to assess national security risks. Both sides are due in court in Florida Thursday. Kerry Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
Inspectors from the IAEA have arrived in southern Ukraine to begin assessing the safety of Europe's largest nuclear power plant. NPR's Jeff Brumfield has more.
There's plenty for nuclear inspectors to investigate at the Zaporizhzhia plant. The sprawling complex is Europe's largest nuclear power station. In recent weeks, it's been battered by shelling, power cuts, and wildfires burning nearby. Inspectors will be looking at the plant's physical security and safety systems. They'll also be talking to Ukrainian staff who are working under the Russian military. Former IAEA inspector Shirley Johnson says that those interviews are perhaps the most important part of the mission.
It kind of depends on whether the Ukrainian operators are going to be able to speak truthfully and openly.
Because it's those workers who are keeping the plant safe. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR.
Ang NPR Balita ay hatid sa inyo ng Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. Para sa kaukulang impormasyon tungkol sa aming mga serbisyo, tumawag lamang sa 481-2400.
A report published earlier this month in the journal Communications, Earth and Environment indicates that the Arctic, including parts of Alaska, is warming four times faster than the rest of the world due to climate change. Researchers had previously believed the Arctic was warming twice as fast as other parts of the globe. Mike Litzo is the director of the Kodiak Lab for NOAA Fisheries. He spoke to KMXT's Kirsten Dobroth about how that could and may already be having an effect on coastal communities and Alaskan fisheries.
I wanted to kind of back up and talk about what we already know or knew about climate change in the Arctic and in waters off of Alaska and how that area is warming compared to other parts of the world.
What we already knew about the Arctic was that it was warming faster than the rest of the globe. So that's something that climate scientists call Arctic amplification. And in terms of Alaska and Alaskan fisheries, that really plays out for the Bering Sea. And particularly the northern Bering Sea, that area that's seasonally ice covered, is where you're seeing the most rapid changes, the most rapid loss of sea ice, the most rapid warming in Alaska. And then also it's the place where you're seeing some of the biggest fisheries challenges and fisheries changes to date.
There was a time when extreme weather events, it was more hypothetical that maybe they were tied to climate change. And now we have ways of looking at human-caused climate change and these extreme weather events and understanding that they are driving each other or connected.
That's right. So that's a part of climate science called attribution science. And it used to be that we knew there was a trend in the climate that's caused by humans, but we couldn't tell if an individual, say, low sea ice year was related to human activities. And that's changed. So now, as these really warm years come across our observational horizon, we can make pretty good determinations about how much of a human contribution there is. So for the Bering Sea in particular, we can see that human fingerprint arising as early as the 1960s and 1970s. And it's gotten to the point where since, the early 2000s, we've been in these temperatures that you can only explain with human activity in the Bering. The Bering's just gotten much, much warmer, much more quickly, say, than the Gulf. And that does seem to be part of that Arctic amplification.
What are some of the changes that we're seeing in fisheries in Alaska because of that?
The really noteworthy immediate response in the Bering was watching the pollock and the cod go north really fast. So the oceanographers had always told us fishery scientists that we should expect winter sea ice to be in the northern Bering Sea for the rest of our lifetimes. And then suddenly that wasn't true. We got a couple of years where there was no sea ice all the way up to Bering Strait in March in the depths of winter. And then the next summer, when we went out and did our bottom trawl survey, we found pollock and cod way north, like up north of St. Lawrence Island, where they never had been before. And the Russians have had commercial fisheries for pollock in the Chukchi Sea in recent years, which is totally, off the hook in terms of how the system used to behave. So that's a big initial consequence. And an interesting thing there for pollock is that the Bering Sea shelf that supports all these fisheries gets smaller as you go farther north up to the strait. And so when you look at the density of pollock in those years when they're way far north, they're at a much higher density than they typically are farther south. It looks like the population is getting squeezed into this area of available habitat far north. So we don't know how that's going to play out over time. Then the other big fisheries impact that we're seeing is snow crab. Around the Arctic, snow crab exist in the Atlantic and in the Pacific Arctic, and they always exist in places that are seasonally ice covered. And as the Southeast Bering Sea has lost its seasonal ice cover, we've seen these big outsized declines in snow crab, and that's having huge ongoing impacts on the fishery that are playing out right now. And so that's the other really big consequence that we're tracking.
So when you're looking at some of these changes in fisheries and also at some of these extreme weather events, whether it's marine heat waves or loss of sea ice, and then you look at this new research that came out, how does that affect your work? Does it factor into it at this point, or how do you interpret that information?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I guess that comes to like the perspective that we have at NOAA Fisheries, where we're fishery scientists and we're not climate scientists. So we try to use the lessons of climate science, obviously, to understand what's happening with these fisheries. But that study was more about recognizing where we are. Oh my gosh, four times faster than the global average. That's something. And then that question of whether it's internal variability and we should expect it to ease over time, or whether it's underappreciated consequences of global warming that the climate models don't get. So I guess big picture, as we go forward, we know the direction that human activities are taking the climate, but the details are important, and the details are really hard to resolve until they play out. You know, the future is a very hard thing to study. So I guess that, to my mind, that's the biggest lesson for fisheries scientists, is just how much uncertainty remains for us. And really that uncertainty goes either way. You know, things could change more slowly than we think they're going to, but they could also change more quickly than we think we're going to. And really, I guess, if you just look at what's happened since 1979, things have changed more quickly than we thought they should.
And for all of us who are not scientists and live in coastal communities, or maybe make our livelihood off of fishing, whether that's commercial or subsistence, what is the takeaway? Like, what can we take from this information and from this discussion?
We naturally evaluate risk in a system based on what we know. Like, if I'm a set netter in Kodiak, and I've been set netting for 20 years, I've had my good years, I've had my bad years, and they form this sort of envelope of expectations. And that's true of anyone who's operating in any fishery around Alaska. I think that one of the big takeaways is that that lived experience, that historical experience of what we should expect, is increasingly not relevant to what's actually happening. And so that's one of the biggest lessons, is giving up on that past experience and trying to understand where we are and how different this current climate is from what we knew even a decade ago.
That was KMXT's Kirsten Dobroth speaking with the director of the Kodiak Lab for NOAA Fisheries, Mike Litzo. Litzo is also on the KMXT board of directors, which does not direct news coverage. Two boats have sunk near Nepakiak over the last month. KYUK's Will McCarthy has more on the state of recovery efforts at the site.
A small ship graveyard is forming outside of Nepakiak after a 20-by-45-foot barge sank into the Kuskokwim River last Wednesday. The barge had been brought upriver to help recover a different boat, which sank a few weeks ago at the end of July. That boat was being used by the Bethel Contracting Company Jobs Done Right to transport equipment to Nepakiak for construction on the high school. Jobs Done Right, which is owned by Job Hale, was subcontracted by H Construction to work on the school. Nepakiak's high school is currently operating with remote learning while they wait for construction to be completed. After the first boat sank, Jobs Done Right brought in a Homer-based company called Ketchumek Marine to help salvage it. Then, the barge that they brought sank too. Earl Brock, Ketchumek Marine's salvage master, said no one saw either vessel sink. He believes for the barge, the storm last week was likely to blame.
I am sure that between the high waves, the high wind, and all the other things that could possibly go wrong, Murphy showed up and that was the end of it.
The storm's high winds meant flooding and large waves on the Kuskokwim, which Brock thinks swamped the barge. The barge was being used as a work platform for salvage divers who were attaching lift bags to help float the first sunken boat. But it's unclear why the original landing craft sank at the end of July. Brock said it's likely no one will ever know.
I'm going to tell you that if you talk to 15 different people in the community, you'll get 15 different answers. What I'll also tell you is that nobody has a smoking gun, rock-solid explanation of why the landing craft sank. Nobody does.
Job Hale, the owner of Jobs Done Right, directed all questions about the sinking of both ships back to Brock. According to Brock, no one was on either vessel when they sank. The boats are not blocking river traffic at Nepakiak, and both the barge and the original boat have since been secured to land. He claims that there is minimal environmental concern and that no fuel is currently leaking.
We don't see any environmental threat or any issues. There is a very, very, very small amount of fuel that was released when the vessels went down. Possibly less than a gallon, but a gallon looks like a lot of fuel. We are talking very small quantity.
If there is oil in the water, the Coast Guard said it would be Jobs Done Right and Ketchumek Marine's responsibility to clean it up. The Coast Guard said they had only just received a report of the sunken barge on Monday, and that the owner's report will dictate whether they go to inspect the two sunken vessels. Owners are supposed to report sunken vessels to the Coast Guard immediately and submit a written report within 5 days. Kevin Williams, a marine casualty investigator with the Coast Guard's Anchorage sector, said that, especially for the first boat that sank, there's a lot they don't know.
We don't know if the tanks are full, if they're half empty, if there's oil in the bilges in the engine room. We're not even sure. The vessel name that was given to us is not even in our database.
Brock, the salvage master, gave no timeline for recovery of the two vessels, but he said they're currently constructing rigging to help refloat the two boats.
Well, we're still in the middle of sourcing the equipment we need, but the short version is we're going to lift them up, refloat them, and take them and deal with them once they're refloated.
He doesn't expect either of them to be damaged. Job Hale, the owner of Jobs Done Right, said the sinking of the two boats has not impacted the timeline of the school's construction. Hale said he already had all the equipment he needed in Nepakiak before the landing craft sank. According to Sally Benedict, the site administrator for Nepakiak Schools, construction was supposed to be completed on August 21st. The school is still waiting to be hooked up to water and heat before they bring students back into the building. In Bethel, I'm Will McCarthy.
An Anchorage man arrested on manslaughter charges in the beating death of his father, a former state legislator, has now been indicted for murder. Anchorage police arrested 36-year-old Talon Westlake on August 20th and charged him with manslaughter, which is an accusation that he recklessly caused the death of his father, 62-year-old Dean Westlake, who had served in the state house representing Northwest Alaska in 2017. But on Monday, an Anchorage grand jury indicted Talon Westlake on charges of first-degree murder, that is, for allegedly acting with intent in killing his father, and second-degree murder under the alternate theory that he showed, quote, extreme indifference, close quote, to his father's life. Assistant District Attorney Trina Sears says she can't discuss what specific new evidence came to light.
Even when somebody's arrested, the investigation continues in the case. It doesn't stop. And so, you know, in this case, you know, between gathering evidence, medical evidence, police investigation just continued and we got more information.
According to the initial charges, Dean had planned to evict Talon from an apartment Dean's girlfriend owns. A neighbor heard them arguing hours before Talon called the police to say Dean wasn't breathing, and officers found Dean dead with blood on the floor and walls and looking like he'd been, quote, pummeled, the manslaughter charges say. Alaskans trap and snare all over the state for food and fur, and every once in a while a pet might get into one by accident. At a recent workshop in Petersburg, a state biologist and local trappers came together to teach the public what to do if that happens.
Eric Dreisbaugh stands at the front of a room in the Petersburg Public Library holding up a conibear trap. He and others are using a stuffed husky to illustrate how to release dogs out of different types of traps and snares. It's part of a presentation by the local office of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. The conibear, or body grip trap, is one of the most worrisome. It's the kind that snaps shut around an animal's neck with the intention of a humane kill.
So like you said, you're going to want to work rapidly on this.
Dreisbaugh then demonstrates a trick for releasing the trap using a dog leash.
You run it through. Bring it back to you. Run it through one more time.
By looping the leash through the trap, you can get more leverage by placing the leash's handle on your foot and pulling the other end with your hand.
And then, like right now, you can get him out. Without even putting the safety on, you should be able to pull his head out.
Dreisbaugh knows a few tricks like this as a trapper and a pet owner. 6 years ago, he was busy cutting wood with his family when one of his young labs got caught in a wolf snare. He was able to release the dog, who ended up going to the vet for a bulging eye caused by ruptured blood vessels. But the dog quickly recovered, and the family didn't blame the trapper. Here's Eric's wife, Lindsay Dreisbaugh, talking to the local radio station about it.
It was purely our fault. The trapper did everything right. Everything was marked and labeled as it should have been. It was just a case of losing track of our dog.
How many pets get into traps and snares in Alaska is unknown. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game does not track that data. Anecdotally, it's more common in other parts of the state, according to Frank Robbins, a state biologist managing lands in Central Southeast. Previously, he worked in Glen Allen and told the Petersburg crowd that it's not in a trapper's best interest to catch anything other than what they're after. In general, he says, They're a conscientious group.
And most trappers are ethical. And ethical trappers won't place traps in places that are, you know, well known to dog walkers or trails that are super active. Unfortunately, it still might happen.
Trapping seasons for various animals runs from the fall through the spring, but mostly in the winter months. One of the traps used in the state's presentation was found earlier in the day near a creek outside of town. Maybe it was from last year and forgotten, or maybe it was someone intentionally setting out of season. Either way, it's rare to run into them. Many Alaska communities have laws preventing trappers from setting in populated areas. But Alaskans also like to go off trail with their dogs. Workshop attendee Karen Rosvald says she sometimes takes her dog to a frozen slough for ice skating.
So if I'm ice skating and going from the Omer Creek little trail bridge all the way down to Blind Slough, doing that whole circuit, and then you'll find, you know, you find beaver holes and stuff, and I don't know who's setting back there.
To prevent problem encounters, some trappers, like Adam Ware, display notices nearby.
I usually put in a Ziploc bag, gallon size, with a paper written in Sharpie, like, hey, trapping area. I make sure that stays up and visible.
Ware was also helping at the workshop. He says he learned early on to be responsible for his traps.
My dad raised me and my older brothers and my younger brother trapping. Basically, since we're little kids, we've just went out and set, just basically teaching us how to live off the land.
The State Department, along with the Alaska Trappers Association, created a Trapper's Code of Ethics and a manual for getting pets out of traps. Those can be found online, along with how-to videos by the ADF&G. Reporting in Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
Today's KMXT Local News is brought to you in part by Discover Kodiak, a one-stop source for visitor information on Kodiak and other destinations around the state. On the web at kodiak.org and at the Visitor Center in the Ferry Terminal Building at 100 Marine Way, 486-4782.
Insight Daily Radio.
From food to fashion, science to tech talk, or for just plain fun, we've got you covered. From the Art of All Things, here's Lasana Jeffries.
Scientists have created the most extensive brain map to date of a person with an extremely rare form of blindness. Objects are invisible unless they are moving. A 48-year-old woman from Scotland wasn't born blind. She was left without sight 18 years ago after a respiratory infection, a series of strokes, and an 8-month coma. About 6 months after emerging from the coma was the first time she reported seeing something, the reflections glinting off a metallic gift bag, like fireworks. She visited an ophthalmologist 2 years after the initial incident and noted that she had no useful vision, but then was able to mirror his arm movements and name the colors of large moving objects. So she was referred to Western University's Brain and Mind Institute in London, Canada. They concluded that she has something called Rittig syndrome, or the Rittig phenomenon, also known as statokinetic dissociation, where someone who is otherwise blind can see moving objects. The opposite condition, wherein the patient can only see stationary objects, also exists. It's called akinetopsia. Nevertheless, she shows a remarkably robust preserved ability to perceive motion, enabling her to navigate through cluttered environments and perform actions like catching moving balls. It seems that her brain has rewired its visual processing, retaining what it could. In this case, that's motion perception. It's a case that provides remarkable insight into brain plasticity, joining a growing body of evidence that human and animal brains are capable of widespread rewiring when damaged. Thanks for listening. I'm Lisanna Jeffries.
Insight Daily Radio.
The polls have closed on the August 16th primary election. Preliminary results have been released online by the Alaska Division of Elections. Final results will not be posted until Wednesday, August 31st, giving time for all ballots postmarked by Election Day to be counted, including mail ballots from rural Alaska, from college students in the lower 48, and from Alaskans serving in our military abroad. This message is sponsored by Alaskans for Better Elections.
Thank you.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to Wednesday. It is the 31st and last day of August, the year 2022. The sun rose today at 7:08. It will set again at 9:09. That will give us 14 hours and 1 minute of daylight, a loss of 4 minutes and 52 seconds compared to yesterday. Our record low for this date was 36 degrees, set in 1955 and 1973, and our record high was 75 degrees, set in 1930. Currently 56 degrees, with a light rain outside. We're looking for more rain this afternoon and a high near 60, south winds to 15, gusting to 20. Scattered showers tonight, at least until 11 p.m., cloudy skies overnight becoming partly cloudy with a low of about 50. West wind to 15, gusting to 20. For tomorrow, mostly sunny skies, a 10% chance of showers after 5 p.m. West winds to 10 and a high near 57. We have a high tide coming up. That will happen at 5:14 this afternoon here on the east side and be 8.6 feet, followed by a low tide at 11:31 p.m. of 6/10. Over on the west side, your high tide will happen at 5:42 and be 14.2 feet in Larsen Bay, followed by a low tide right after midnight at 12:02 a.m. of 6/10.
Hello, this is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in Kodiak with Kodiak Commercial Salmon Fishery Advisory Announcement number 34, date issued 10 a.m. on August 31st. There will be a 120-hour extension to the current commercial salmon fishing period from 6 p.m. Wednesday, August 31st, until 6 p.m. Monday, September 5th, in the following areas: in the Outer Karluk section of the Southwest Kodiak District, the Central and North Cape sections of the Northwest Kodiak District, the Southwest Afognak section of the Afognak District. There will be a 54-hour commercial salmon fishing period from noon Saturday, September 3rd, until 6 p.m. Monday, September 5th, in the following areas: in the Eastside Kodiak District, except for the Inner Yugak and Outer Yugak Bay sections remain closed, the Outer Aikuluk section of the Southwest Kodiak District, and the Cape, Igvak, White Bay, Alinchak Bay, Katmai, and Dakavak Bay sections of the Mainland District. Closed waters are expanded until 6 p.m. Monday, September 5th, at Molina Creek to consist of all waters within 1/2 nautical mile of the beach near the stream terminus of Molina Creek, stream number 251105, between 58 degrees 10 north latitude and 58 degrees 11 north latitude. As previously announced, the following areas will close to commercial salmon fishing at 6 p.m. Wednesday, August 31st, the Iziut Bay section of the Afognak District. Fishermen are reminded that until further notice, in that portion of the northwest and southwest Kodiak districts, south of a latitude of Cape Kuliuk, king salmon 28 inches or greater in length may not be retained by purse seine gear in the commercial fishery and must be returned to the water unharmed. Other closed waters are shown in Kodiak Area Salmon Statistical Chart, detailed in Commercial Salmon Fishing Regulations and Statistical Charts. Harvest strategies and commercial salmon fishing regulations are available at the Kodiak Fish and Game Office. And, of course, the most recent salmon fisher information may be obtained by calling the department's 24-hour recorder phone at 486-4559. Thank you very much. Good luck fishing. This is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
And, Mariners, here is your weather forecast for Marmot Island to Sitkanat, Kodiak's east side. Small craft advisory through tonight. Southwest 30 today, seas to 9 feet. For tonight, west 25, seas remaining to 9 feet. And for tomorrow, southwest 20 knots, seas to 7 feet. Over in the Shelikof Strait, small craft advisory tonight and Thursday. Southeast 20 today, seas to 4 feet. Southwest 25 tonight, seas coming up to 7 feet. And southwest 25 tomorrow, seas at 6 feet on our west side. There will be a celebration of life for Margaret Lucine Roberts that will be held on Saturday at 3 p.m. at the Afognak Native Corporation building on Near Island. The family invites all who knew and loved Margaret to come, share a story, and leave your favorite memory in her honor. If you'd like to bring a dish to share, please deliver it to Susan Malutin at the Afognak building between 1 and 2 p.m. on Saturday. The senior citizens of Kodiak will be holding a board meeting on Wednesday. That's going to be going on at 1 p.m. tomorrow in the multipurpose room at the... Oh, that's today. That'll be going on in a half hour in the Kodiak Senior Center. The public is invited to attend. Call the center at 486-6181 for more information. Also today at 3:30 p.m., the library will be hosting their Lego Club. Children under 10 must be accompanied by an adult. Tomorrow at 10:30 a.m., the library will host a Lapsit story time. It's for babies 0 to 3 and their adults. Join volunteer Abby Hanna to share a story and a song and some quality time to play and socialize. Call the library with questions at 486-8686. Also on Thursday at 3 p.m. is the library's next chess club meeting. Drop in to learn, practice, or sharpen your chess skills in a cozy, friendly environment. No experience is necessary, and it's open to all ages. And the library is hosting a new reading challenge that's starting September 1st. It'll run through the month of September, focusing on NASA's first mission of the Artemis spaceflight program. Register for the new reading challenge on Beanstack. Read and complete activities for this challenge in September. Learn more about the Artemis program and NASA's plans for a new generation of crewed spaceflight. Visit the library's homepage for more details. And the Kodiak Rodeo and State Fair is happening this weekend, September 3rd and 4th. Lots happening at the Kodiak Rodeo, including barrel racing, ribbon roping, pole bending. And at the State Fair, if you can make it, build it, grow it, or harvest it, you can enter it. They're calling everyone from artists to photographers, bakers, gardeners, quilters. Submit your entries at the exhibit hall, and you can do so Thursday, September 1st, between 4 p.m. and 7 p.m., and Friday, September 2nd, between 11 a.m. and 6 p.m.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT three times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the midday report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.